Penguin Random House Audio presents Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania by Eric Larson, read for you by Scott Brick. Mining Suspense, A Note to Readers. I first started reading about the Lusitania on a whim, following my between-books strategy of reading voraciously and promiscuously. What I learned both charmed and horrified me. I thought I knew everything there was to know about the incident, but as so often happens when I do deep research on a subject, I quickly realized how wrong I was. Above all, I discovered that buried in the muddled details of the affair, deliberately muddled in certain aspects, was something simple and satisfying, a very good story. I hasten to add, as always, that this is a work of non-fiction. Anything between quotation marks comes from a memoir, letter, telegram, or other historical document. My goal was to try to marshal the many nodes of real-life suspense and, yes, romance that marked the Lusitania episode in a manner that would allow readers to experience it as did people who lived through it at the time, although squeamish readers may wish to skip the details of a certain autopsy that appears late in the narrative. In any event, I give you now the saga of the Lusitania and the myriad forces, large and achingly small, that converged one lovely day in May 1915 to produce a tragedy of monumental scale, whose true character and import have long been obscured in the mists of history. Eric Larson, Seattle. A word about time. To avoid confusing myself and readers, I've converted German submarine time to Greenwich Mean Time. Thus, an entry in Kapitänleutnant Walter Schwieger's war log for 3 p.m. becomes 2 p.m. instead. As for Britain's Admiralty, it is important always to keep in mind that the Admiralty's top official was the First Lord, who served as a kind of chief executive officer. His second in command was First Sea Lord, essentially the chief operating officer, in charge of day-to-day naval operations. The captains are to remember that whilst they are expected to use every diligence to secure a speedy voyage, they must run no risk which by any possibility might result in accident to their ships. They will ever bear in mind that the safety of the lives and property entrusted to their care is the ruling principle which should govern them in the navigation of their ships, and no supposed gain in expedition or saving of time on the voyage is to be purchased at the risk of accident. Rules to be observed in the company's service. The Cunard Steamship Company Limited, March 1913. The first consideration is the safety of the U-boat. Admiral Reinhard Scheer, Germany's High Sea Fleet in the World War, 1919. A word from the captain. On the night of May 6th, 1915, as his ship approached the coast of Ireland, Captain William Thomas Turner left the bridge and made his way to the first-class lounge, where passengers were taking part in a concert and talent show, a customary feature of Cunard crossings. The room was large and warm, paneled in mahogany and carpeted in green and yellow, with 2 14-foot-tall fireplaces in the front and rear walls. Ordinarily, Turner avoided events of this kind aboard ship because he disliked the social obligations of captaincy. But tonight was no ordinary night, and he had news to convey. There was already a good deal of tension in the room, despite the singing and piano playing and clumsy magic tricks, and this became more pronounced when Turner stepped forward at intermission. His presence had the perverse effect of affirming everything the passengers had been fearing since their departure from New York, in the way that a priest's arrival tends to undermine the cheery smile of a nurse. It was Turner's intention, however, to provide reassurance. His looks helped. With the physique of a bank safe, He was the embodiment of quiet strength. He had blue eyes and a kind and gentle smile, and his graying hair, he was 58 years old, conveyed wisdom and experience, as did the mere fact of his being a Cunard captain. In accord with Cunard's practice of rotating captains from ship to ship, this was his third stint as the Lusitania's master, his first in wartime. Turner now told his audience that the next day, Friday, May 7th, the ship would enter waters off the southern coast of Ireland that were part of a zone of war designated by Germany. This, in itself, was anything but news. On the morning of the ship's departure from New York, a notice had appeared on the shipping pages of New York's newspapers. Placed by the German embassy in Washington, it reminded readers of the existence of the war zone and cautioned that vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or of any of her allies are liable to destruction, and that travelers sailing on such ships do so at their own risk. Though the warning did not name a particular vessel, it was widely interpreted as being aimed at Turner's ship, the Lusitania, and indeed in at least one prominent newspaper, the New York World, it was positioned adjacent to Cunard's own advertisement for the ship. Ever since, about all the passengers had been doing was thinking, dreaming, sleeping, and eating submarines, according to Oliver Bernard, a theater set designer traveling in first class. Turner now revealed to the audience that earlier in the evening the ship had received a warning by wireless of fresh submarine activity off the Irish coast. He assured the audience there was no need for alarm. Coming from another man, this might have sounded like a baseless palliative, but Turner believed it. He was skeptical of the threat posed by German submarines, especially when it came to his ship, one of the great transatlantic Greyhounds, so named for the speeds they could achieve. His superiors at Cunard shared his skepticism. The company's New York manager issued an official response to the German warning. "The truth is that the Lusitania is the safest boat on the sea. She is too fast for any submarine. No German war vessel can get her or near her." Turner's personal experience affirmed this. On two previous occasions, while captain of a different ship, he had encountered what he believed were submarines and had successfully eluded them by ordering full speed ahead. He said nothing about these incidents to his audience. Now he offered a different sort of reassurance. Upon entering the war zone the next day, the ship would be securely in the care of the Royal Navy. He bade the audience good night and returned to the bridge. The talent show continued. A few passengers slept fully clothed in the dining room for fear of being trapped below decks in their cabins if an attack were to occur. One especially anxious traveler, a Greek carpet merchant, put on a life jacket and climbed into a lifeboat to spend the night. Another passenger, a New York businessman named Isaac Lehman, took a certain comfort from the revolver that he carried with him always, and that would, all too soon, bring him a measure of fame and infamy. With all but a few lights extinguished and all shades pulled and curtains drawn, the great liner slid forward through the sea, at times in fog, at times under a lacework of stars. But even in darkness, in moonlight and mist, the ship stood out. At 1 o'clock in the morning, Friday, May 7th, the officers of a New York-bound vessel spotted the Lusitania and recognized it immediately as it passed some 2 miles off. "You could see the shape of the four funnels," said the captain, Thomas M. Taylor. "She was the only ship with four funnels." Unmistakable and invulnerable, a floating village in steel, the Lusitania glided by in the night as a giant black shadow cast upon the sea. Part 1. Bloody Monkeys. Lusitania, the Old Sailor Man. The smoke from ships and the exhalations of the river left a haze that blurred the world.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?